This is Nancy Dwyer
and Rocky Alvey
for Stellar Conversations, recorded at Vanderbilt University's Dyer Observatory.
I'm Rick Chappell, the director of the Vanderbilt Dyer Observatory, and we're having another Stellar Conversation, this time with Dr. Bill Sheehan, who's a very special man who's visiting with us on the occasion of the 150th anniversary of the birth of E.E. Barnard, who was a very, very special astronomer who worked at Vanderbilt in the 1880s. It's great to have Bill here. Bill is a psychiatrist. He's from Minnesota. He's an amateur astronomer for his whole life. He's written many books related to astronomy, has done a lot of observing himself. And Bill, it's a pleasure to have you.
It's wonderful to be here. It's just exciting.
Thank you. The book that you've written about Dr. Barnard, The Immortal Fire Within, is an absolutely amazing book. And I was tremendously influenced by the magnitude of his accomplishment. Can you tell us a little bit about Dr. Barnard and his early life and his astronomy accomplishments?
Well, I started my interest in astronomy when I was 9 years old, and the name E.E. Barnard quickly became familiar to me even at that time because his accomplishments were so widespread that anyone with an interest in astronomy soon discovers that he is one of the leading figures in the field. And he grew up here in Nashville. Was born in 1857, and so his early life was on the verge of being desperate, on the verge of starvation, and during the years of great adversity when Nashville was occupied by Union troops, and he just struggled to get along. But he had a supportive mother, somebody that had named him Emerson after Ralph Waldo, a New England writer, and clearly encouraged his interest in acquiring knowledge about things to the best of her ability. And he used to lie out in an old wagon bed looking at the stars at night. And one can easily imagine for a small child under those kinds of circumstances that was probably as much a refuge at that stage for him as it was the passion that it later became. But his beginnings really were just as somebody looking out there at something that evoked a better place than the one that he was in at the time.
Mm-hmm. So he had to go to work at an early age to help support his mom.
Yeah. When he was born, his father was already deceased. Reuben Barnard had died about 3 months before he was born. His mother was 42 and had to care both for Edward and Edward's older brother, who apparently was somewhat feeble-minded and probably not very much support to the family. And she tried for a while to make a living modeling flowers and wax and started having health problems of her own. And so when he was not quite 9 years old, after having only 2 months of formal education, she was able to secure a job for him at a photograph gallery that was owned by John H. Van Staveren, who was a acquaintance of hers from happier days in Cincinnati. And Barnard's first job was to turn the handles of a large camera that was used to make photographic enlargements. And this camera was situated on the rooftop of the building, and Barnard's job was to guide it on the sun so that it would be able to do the work that was needed by the photographers. It was extremely tedious work, and several other youngsters had been hired for the position and became somnolent, both by the lack of stimulation and also sort of sitting there, you know, with the warm sun beating down on them. And but for some reason, Barnard said, his mother assured John Van Staveren that he could be relied upon to stay awake. And since Barnard later became known as the man who never slept, I think she probably knew something about him even at that early age.
That's right.
And one of the ironies is that this camera was known as the Jupiter because of its size. And it's the kind of incident that if you were to read it in a novel, you would say, well, this is just too implausible. I mean, the artist is taking liberties here, heavy-handed foreshadowing or something. So, but he succeeded in that job. The photograph gallery became for him a surrogate family. He eventually met his wife through his relationship with two English artists that had come to the photograph gallery from Yorkshire, named the Calvert brothers, and it also became something of a university for him because he came in contact with some very stimulating people, including James Braid, who was sort of an electrical genius and was the chief operator, in other words, the lead photographer at the time that he was there, and later founded Braid Electric, which I think still exists in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And he was instrumental, for instance, in setting up the first telephone connection in Nashville, Braid. Yeah. And Braid helped Barnard assemble a couple primitive telescopes and got him started in that way. And so Barnard really, despite not having the formal education that he wished he could have had, learned a great deal from interacting with people of this sort. And I think that mentoring relationship that he had with these people was really which saved him from.
Mm-hmm. So he began to learn about the stars. He got a rudimentary telescope and then a better one, I guess, and went through this incredible period where it was originally sort of naked eye astronomy, and then photography became part of astronomy. And he, of course, he had worked in this photographic gallery, so he knew about photography. So both his knowledge of the heavens and his abilities with cameras, I guess, came together during his career and allowed him to do some amazing things.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was fortunate in that he gained a great deal of expertise in a technique which was about to revolutionize astronomy. When Barnard was working at the photograph gallery, it was still the old wet process daguerreotype plates, and that's one of the reasons why this large condensing camera was needed. Is they were very slow plates, and so not very sensitive. And astronomically, even though there were some curiosities that had been obtained by 1850, there had been some rudimentary photographs of the sun and the moon and so forth. Photography really didn't become a major technique for astronomical purposes until the 1880s, when dry plates were introduced that allowed long exposures of the sky. And the advantage of photography really was that it allowed cumulative recording of faint objects like stars and nebulae. And so Barnard had really become an expert in this technique before it was introduced into astronomical circles, and quickly became a leader and a pioneer in finding out how to exploit this new technology to revolutionize our understanding of particularly the galaxy and to a certain extent also comets by taking wide-angle photographs with a very, very simple and very inexpensive lens.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you know if you get anywhere near astronomy is that there are a whole lot of things named for Barnard. So there are lots and lots of things that he discovered. Could you mention a few of those?
Yeah, I'm not sure if any astronomer has had more objects named for him, but certainly there were the comets that he discovered. And one of the reasons that he took up comet seeking is it was one of the things that he could do with a small telescope as a untrained person in Nashville. Had a keen eye and diligence, and he started discovering scads of comets. And one of the things is traditionally comets are named for the discoverers, so that was a great way for him to establish a reputation for himself, because there started to be all of these comets Barnard. Eventually he discovered 19 comets and was the second most prolific discoverer of comets, American discoverer of comets, behind William R. Brooks of New York, who stayed at it longer. So all those comets Barnard. There's Barnard's Loop, which is a nebulosity in Orion, of which the Orion Nebula is part. All the dark nebulae of the Milky Way are called Barnard objects, and there are 192 of those. There's an asteroid named after Barnard. There's Barnard's Galaxy, There have been craters on the moon and Mars that have been named in his honor. So it reminds me a little bit of the saying that is in Christopher Wren's tomb in St. Paul's Cathedral, which is, of course, what Christopher Wren designed. And it says, if you seek his monument, look around you. And in Barnard's case, the whole heavens is his monument. And one certainly can't ask for a more grandiose memorial than that.
So he is really an incredible example of an individual who had no special advantages in his youth. In fact, if anything, a very strong negative situation from which to rise. Intently driven by curiosity and achieving the best you can be in the world in astronomy.
Yeah, I think his career is almost without example. I mean, certainly there are some other astronomers who accomplished as much as he did in probably the significance of what they did, but I don't think there's any astronomer who came as far from sort of the humble beginnings that he did and achieved as much as he did. So from that standpoint, he really is not only a significant figure in astronomy, but an inspiration and in some ways a real paragon of the human spirit in his drive and ability to overcome all of the adversity that he did. So his life is really almost like something out of Dickens or something. It's just
Seems like it couldn't possibly be true.
Exactly.
It has to be fictional.
There aren't very many of us that can make excuses because we all pretty much started with better circumstances than he did, and few of us have accomplished anything close to what he did on an average night.
Yeah, I know in your book you on the chapter about his discovering the fifth satellite of Jupiter, that the chapter is called Immortality, and say just a few words about that discovery, because that was an amazing thing. I guess it had been almost 300 years since Galileo found the first four moons of Jupiter.
It was the discovery. In retrospect, it certainly wasn't the most important discovery that he made. I mean, there are now, as of the latest count, 63 moons of Jupiter. But at the time, 1892, he had just managed to wangle some time on the 36-inch telescope at Lick Observatory, which was the largest telescope in the world. Prior to that, as a junior astronomer, he'd not received access to that telescope on a regular basis.
And that's Northern California, so near San Jose.
Yeah, near San Jose. And he eventually had to go to the Regents over the director's head in order to get access to the telescope. And then within a month of having one night a week on this telescope, he made this fantastic discovery. And it really captured the world's imagination, because there were four satellites that have been known that were satellites of Jupiter. And, of course, they went back to the very beginnings of telescopic astronomy, where they were the four that Galileo had discovered and that anyone can see in binoculars and small telescopes. And so to add a fifth member to that rather august and stately retinue was seen as quite an achievement. And it was, in fact, the last satellite of a planet that was discovered visually. All the others have been discovered photographically. And it immediately catapulted the Lick Observatory and E.E. Barnard into international fame. It's somewhat interesting because he had a really hard time deciding what to name the satellite. And at one point, he was going to name it Columbia, because it was the year of the Columbia Exposition, 1892. And also, it was briefly mooted on his behalf to call it Eureka, which was, of course, the exclamation of discovery and also the motto of the state of California. Finally, a French astronomer filled the gap by calling it Amalthea, which was the name of the nurse of Jupiter. And he didn't like any of the mythological names because he thought they were all like mistresses and lovers of Jupiter and hence immoral. So he continued to the end of his life referring it to simply as the fifth satellite.
And so he, after that, as you say, he became known internationally. And I guess he was given a very special award in Europe after that.
Yeah, he received just about every significant award in astronomy of his time. Probably the most impressive one was the gold medal of the Royal Astronomical Society, because at that time England was the leader in all fields of science. He won awards from the French Academy of Science. He won the Bruce Medal of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, which had been founded by Edward Holden, the first director of the Lick Observatory, and just on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And his cabinet was full of medals and awards, and really mm-hmm. he was one of the most celebrated and most honored astronomers of his time.
I know after that discovery of the fifth moon of Jupiter, and on his way to receive the award in Europe, he came through Nashville and was given an honorary doctorate degree by Vanderbilt University.
He was. I'm not exactly sure, but I believe that it was the first honorary doctorate that was ever awarded at Vanderbilt.
And I think it's the only one that's ever been awarded.
It may well be.
I think it is the only one. Chancellor Garland, I think,
gave
that to him. I want to wrap up by just getting you to comment on something that I think Barnard is an exquisite example of, as we've talked about, but that reflects a challenge that we have in America with respect to having our kids understand and know explorers on a personal basis from the viewpoint of having mentors for their future career decisions. We don't do a good job in America these days of telling the story of scientists and explorers, and so our kids don't know anything about them. They know about entertainers and athletes, and that's only, we tell those stories, but we don't tell the science stories. Your story of Barnard is a wonderful story, and he's obviously a person that's worthy of having a story told about him, as I think is the case with hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands and thousands, of other scientists. So what's your thinking with respect to challenges America has in telling the stories of our explorers?
Well, I think that's a really good question. The real thing that sort of seems to immediately come to mind is that there's a stereotype of what a scientist's life is all about, which is completely, I think, false, but it's pervasive, and that is that scientists are somehow people who completely efface their own personalities, that they approach their subject matter clinically, dispassionately, that they're looking for facts, and that they spend a lot of time sort of in isolation in laboratories, wearing white coats and wearing horn-rimmed glasses, and we're glad they're around because they're finding cures for cancer and doing the basic research to allow us to have technological gadgets and things, but we really wouldn't want to be one ourselves. And the reality is that I think scientists are intriguing people. They're often idiosyncratic and eccentric, but they're also people who have profound passions, great sort of specialized knowledge about certain things, talents that may be balanced by idiosyncrasies. But the real thing I think that motivates scientists is the same thing that motivates anyone, and that is excitement about what they're doing. And I think one of the things that occurs to me about Barnard, but also other scientists that I've known, is that they get intense pleasure in what they do. It's addictive to make discoveries. And once you've made a discovery, you want to repeat that process in the future. And to me, one of the real questions about our whole species, really, is whether we are, in fact, an inquisitive species that asks questions and wants to find out, you know, what are those things, those lights up there that I'm looking at from this wagon bed, and what does it mean, and always perhaps pushing forward as much by doubt as by certainty, because I think that that's the Socratic method, and it's also the scientific method, is that you doubt things, and through your doubts, then you acquire what certainty is possible, rather than going by traditional knowledge, texts that other people have written, or doing sort of as you're told. And so scientists really are diverse people. I was an English major as well as a physics major as an undergraduate, and I read about poets, and they had interesting lives. But the scientists that I've studied and written about have been equally compelling personalities to anyone in the arts, and certainly much more so than people in politics and entertainment that I'm aware of. So I think if children can have that same sense of wonder and awe. Francis Bacon had a wonderful statement. He said, "Wonder is the seed of knowledge." And ultimately, I think that it's a little bit like the saying, it isn't the destination, but the journey. I think that sense of wonder is worth more than the knowledge that is acquired. And so one sees that in E.E. Barnard's career, the pictures that show him looking up at the sky, even as an older man, and still having that sense of wonder and waiting for the next eclipse or the next comet to appear. Mm-hmm. So if I could pass that on to kids and make them realize that this career also offers some great horizons for them, I think that that it wouldn't be long before some of them would be wanting to traipse after E.E. Barnard in their own right.
Absolutely. I hope that's what we do in America. You've done a great job with the book, and thank you for being with us on this very special, in this very special year of celebration of a man who was clearly very special to Vanderbilt, very special to Nashville, Tennessee, very special to the United States of America, very special to the world.
Well, I feel a great honor in being the chronicler of such a great man's life. So in following his career, I've been able to experience some of the wonders that he experienced as
great.
Well. Thank
Dr.
you
Bill
so much.
Sheehan, thank you for being with us.
This is Nancy Dwyer
and Rocky Alvey
for Stellar Conversations, brought to you by Vanderbilt University's Public Affairs Department and recorded at Vanderbilt Dyer Observatory.